amen in the malls. I love the factories, I love the rubber balls, I love the ukuleles and the sound of spinning tape.
Hello, and welcome to These Things That People Make, the interview-based show that focuses on craft, zines, and all sorts of things that are not considered fine art, and the politics and stories behind those things. This show is produced out of CFRU, 93.3 FM in Guelph, and syndicated to other campus and community radio stations across Canada. I'm your host, Sarah Mangle. Today I'm airing a really exciting interview with Sarah Marcus, who is the author of Girls to the Front, The True Story of the Ryoko Revolution, published by HarperCollins. And I thought before I air the interview, I would just give a little bit of context. So I'm going to read to you the description of the book found on the book's website, girlstothefront.com. Girls to the Front is a lyrical, punk-infused narrative about a girl of extraordinary young women coming of age angrily, collectively, and publicly. A dynamic chronicle not just of a movement but of an era. This is the story of a time when America thought young people were apathetic and feminism was dead, but a generation of noisy girls rose up to prove everybody wrong. And also from the same website, girlstothefront.com, I just want to read their definition of Riot Girl, which I agree with. Riot Girl roared into the spotlight in 1991, an uncompromising movement of pissed-off girls with no patience for sexism and no intention of keeping quiet. Young women everywhere were realizing that the equality they'd been promised was still elusive, and a newly resurgent right wing was turning feminism into the ultimate dirty word. In response, thousands of Riot Girls published zines, founded local groups, and organized national conventions, while fiercely prophetic punk bands such as Bratmobile, Heaven to Betsy, Huggy Bear, and Bikini Kill helped spread the word across the U.S. and to Canada, Europe, and beyond. I interviewed Sarah Marcus over the phone. She was in Brooklyn, New York, and I was in CFRU in the production studio. We start off the interview with Sarah reading an excerpt from the book, Girls to the Front.
There's no way to map out with any certainty the scattered cartographies of rebellion that were forming by 1993. The punk feminist revolution was spreading like windblown seed, sprouting in the tertiary cities and suburbs and rural roots of North America, growing differently in each place depending on the local climate. Some girls started zines, some formed bands, some just dug into their closets and pulled out the little girl barrettes they'd heard Riot Girls wore, and admired themselves in the mirror with bright plastic butterflies poised on their temples, proud of this new look that said they were doing something different from what everyone wanted them to do. They would not grow up the way adults intended. We know that 75,000 people eventually bought Pussy Whipped, the Bikini Kill record that came out in late 1993, but we don't know how many copies were dubbed on boomboxes and dual cassette decks for how many friends or pen pals, or how many people were riding in the car to school one morning when somebody hit eject on the Lemonhead singing, "Into your arms, oh, oh, into your arms I can go," and swapped in Bikini Kill's Alien She. She wants me to go to the mall. She wants me to put the pretty lipstick on. She wants me to be like her. She wants me to be like her. I want to kill her, but I'm afraid it might kill me. These girls weren't aware that Bratmobile's Aaron Smith had told the British newspaper The Guardian that Riot Girl by name is destined to flop. The whole thing has become diluted, like now it's popular, it's not cool anymore. They didn't know that Toby Vail thought the whole thing had become pointless, or that Molly Newman had drafted, though never published, a piece for Jigsaw titled Revolution Girl ... You Disappoint Me. They just knew that fuck you too, cool schmoll, was exactly what they wanted to scream in the cafeteria every day. And that when they heard Kathleen bellowing, "Dare you to be who you are, dare you to do what you will," they felt an electric charge through their whole body, like they really could do anything.
We're Bikini Kill, and we want revolution! Girls don't know!
You are listening to an interview with Sarah Marcus, author of Girls to the Front, a history of the Riot Girl Revolution. And that was Bikini Kill with Double Daria, referenced in the piece that Sarah Marcus read. She just read an excerpt from her book. And the song was Double Daria. It was from their first EP. And now we're going to go back to the interview. You're listening to These Things That People Make. We're talking about Riot Girl.
Oh man, it's been too long since I've read. I'm glad I'm going out on the road again.
Oh good, when are you doing that?
I'm going to Ann Arbor in a couple weeks, Ann Arbor and Oberlin. Oh no, I'm going to Penn before that. I'm doing this panel discussion with Kathleen Hanna at the University of Pennsylvania.
Cool. What's the focus of the panel?
It's called Revolution Girl Style Again. And it's the two of us and then a woman who started the rock camp in Philly and a musician named Katie Otto who's in a band there.
Cool.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Can you tell me the story of putting the book together?
Basically, I think that I was really working my way toward doing this book for a very long time before I had even decided to write it, just by virtue of the fact that I grew up going to Riot Girl meetings and going to shows and making zines, and then in subsequent years was really putting those ideals to work in various writing that I was doing about music, about feminism, and other activism. And there was a point where I realized that the story of what Riot Girl was getting warped, and I write about this a little bit in the intro about how I felt that a lot of what had been most important in my experience and the experience of a lot of people that I knew was really falling out of the story as it was being told moving forward. And so I just decided that I was going to try to get the story. It's impossible to say get the story right. There are so many stories. But get a story down that reflected what I and people that I knew had known Riot Girl to be. And so first I actually checked in with a couple key people in the book, people that I knew vaguely or through other people, and said, you know, do you think this is a good idea? Do you think I should do it? I know there were all these concerns about representation. And everyone was like, yeah, you should do it. So the process of writing it took 5 years. One of the first things that I did was quit my nonprofit job and go to grad school in creative writing because I had only written magazine articles at that point. I'd never written a book. I didn't know how to write a book. So being in grad school really was completely indispensable in that, to have that kind of support, to have the 2 years of classes to really just focus on becoming a better writer and how do you tell a story and how do you craft a narrative and how do you introduce characters, all kinds of things that don't really come up when you're writing like a 2,500-word feature about some band. So I started writing the book when I was in grad school at Columbia, and then classes ended, and I continued writing, and it really started to come together in a very, very different and substantial way when I was accepted to a residency in New Hampshire in the winter of early 2008, and that stuck me in a one-room studio in the deep and snowy woods of New Hampshire for 6 weeks. And it was sort of like a padded cell, and I just kind of like went into the darkness and figured out how the book was going to work and how everything was going to operate together, because I had, you know, all of these stories that people had told me. I'd interviewed up over 100 people at this point. I'd spent all of my breaks in grad school traveling around to different parts of the country and to different countries, meeting up with people whom I connected with through first Friendster, then MySpace, then Facebook. Thank God for Facebook. So I had all of these stories from people, a million cassette tapes, as well as all of this political background, as well as all the musical stuff. And it was there in the woods of New Hampshire that everything started to coalesce. And it was shortly after that that I signed up with my agent, who's this amazing feminist who's been finding homes in the world for feminist books for decades, and then figured out how the book was going to come out into the world. That's the story.
Do you feel like it shifted the way that you thought about Riot Girl?
You know, it did in certain important ways. Like,
yeah.
One important way was that the negative stuff that comes in at the end about how some people were mean to each other, like, I had no idea about any of that. It wasn't part of my experience. Everything to me had just been, like, really perfect and glorious and empowering, and I think that that was the case for a lot of people, but then for many of the other people, it was irrevocably tainted by people doing political one-upmanship or people trying to act out interpersonal beefs by casting them as political disagreements. So that was something to add to my understanding of it. And another really important thing for me to add, my attitude when I was much younger, when I was a teen involved in this stuff, was like, oh God, why is, like, the music is great and I love the music, but, like, why is it getting all the attention and the grassroots political activities of all these scores and hundreds and thousands of young women being really ignored? So I went into the book sort of, when I began, I wanted to reverse that and kind of, I think that I had a misguided impulse in the beginning to perhaps de-emphasize the music to a degree that was also not true to the reality of how it was, which was that the music was an incredibly important vehicle for these ideas. The songs were like a dream that we were all having at once. And the music was this incredibly powerful metaphor and figure for what it was like to take up space and what it was like to make noise and what it was like to use your voice. So I really came around in a circle to having a much deeper appreciation of, it sounds almost ridiculous for me to say this given what everybody else thinks, like, oh, Riot Grrrl was a musical movement. So it might sound ridiculous for me to say I came around to an appreciation of the role of music in the movement. But that was the journey that I had, and I think that it wound up in the right place.
I think that there's a nice pairing of the like the zine stuff that you talk about and the sort of like consciousness raising get-togethers and the music, like, that feel like it has a sense of cohesiveness in the story. Like, I feel
good,
like
good.
I feel them working together, you know.
Good.
I think it's like, I grew up in rural Nova Scotia and moved to Montreal in the like early 2000s and wrote a zine for a while called Squirrel Grrrl that was like girl written with R's instead of IR, like, but uh-huh. like didn't consciously, like, wasn't part consciously of a punk or a Riot Grrrl anything. And it's just really, was really like exciting and interesting as someone who's like 29 now to read this book and to realize all the ways that my life was actually influenced by Riot Grrrl without actually being in direct contact enough to know the name of it. At that time, like, there's a lot of people in my life now who are really connected to it or felt like Riot Grrrls at the time, but it's just interesting because when I was 22, I worked for 3 years for an NGO that totally co-opted all of the DIY stuff that was taking place, like started like at a national sort of Canadian level, started like autonomous girl-only spaces across Canada without any acknowledgement of Riot Grrrl. Like, just these funny things where it's like, actually what we were doing was getting paid to do the things that 16-year-olds were doing 10 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting because it bespeaks a recognition that this was an incredibly effective model.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and I'm not even sure that I would agree with the use of co-opted if it was, you know, it would be co-opted if it was like creating DIY spaces in order to sell girls' products. But if it's like female empowerment organizations, then, you know, I feel pretty, it's like pretty great that a bunch of like young punks just looking at their own lives were able to figure out models of organizing and empowering and of self-expression that were so effective that like established NGOs hadn't been able to come up with anything better. That's pretty powerful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the reason why I'd say co-opted is that, like, I wish that, in general, in lots of things, I wish that, like, history, like, that people were just credited with the history that they produced, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think NGO culture is a bit complicated, to say the least.
You know me, but you don't.
Today you are in the midst of listening to an interview with Sarah Marcus, who wrote Girls to the Front, a book about the history of Riot Girl. And you just heard Bratmobile from their 7-inch Kiss and Ride, and that was No You Don't. We're going to go back now to the interview.
What's the reception of the book been like so far?
It's been pretty awesome. It's been sort of similar to what you describe, where, you know, yeah. I started writing this book more than 5 years ago, because it took me 5 years to write, but I finished it over a year ago. And when I started it, like, a lot of people I would tell that I was writing it had no idea what Riot Girl was. They weren't sure why it was important to be documented. I didn't have a sense of how broad of an audience it would even find. And I've just been super gratified by the response it's gotten and by the people who've come out to things. There's so much passion around this, in part because nothing this fantastic to express the, like, frustrations and feminist aspirations of young women has really come along to take its place.
Yeah.
Riot Girl still stands in history as this very singular phenomenon whose power is actually it's persisted.
I'm also, like, in particular inspired by the degree of commitment to address and sing about sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And to actively kind of confront those kinds of things in singing and to be really clear.
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge part of the movement and something that, because, I mean, I can't remember, very few people in speaking to me would go on the record about their own histories of abuse.
Yeah.
I recognize that and I really respect it. At the same time, I think that perhaps that has contributed to the fact that people talk about Riot Girl often without actually mentioning this stuff.
Hmm.
And so I wanted to make sure that was really present there, even though there wasn't really somebody's story that I could peg it to, because nobody wants to, and it's really reasonable. Like, nobody wants to be, like, the figurehead in a narrative book, the person whose story, like, is used to exemplify the struggle of, like, survivors of abuse. And I think that a lot of what happened within Riot Girl was that there's this period of time in which telling the stories and breaking the silence around those is really empowering, and then there's a point in time when it's like, I would really love to derive my power from something else now,
please. Yeah.
And that was what, you know, a very articulate woman expressed to me, and I was like, yeah, of course.
I want to ask you about just, like, how it felt to collect so many interviews and so much material from that time period.
It felt incredibly humbling
and
honoring. You know, one of the first interviews that I did was with Mary Margaret Fondrias, who's in the book quite a lot. And she just poured out her heart to me, and we had never met. I was gobsmacked by it. I was completely floored by the trust and the openness that she was displaying. You know, she took me to her house and basically opened up her files and, like, dumped them into my bag. I was like, here, take all of this. Her zine flats, letters. It was astounding. And it was incredibly, it's weird to say disarming, because it's not like I was armed before. But what I mean is that it made me feel deeply, deeply humbled, and like I had a tremendous responsibility to not fuck this up. And so at times I just had so many people's stories in my head, and I would be despondent every so often. There's just no way I'm going to get this right. I'm going to make everybody unhappy, and I'm not going to misuse their trust. But what those fears did was just to inspire me to ever greater diligence in the service of being true to what people were giving me.
I get the sense that you pulled it off really well, based on the way that, like, the story fills out, like that the people are real when I'm reading, like, real people, and that the conflicts or the issues. You did this incredibly difficult thing where you had to paint a picture from a whole bunch of different people's perspectives at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think you pulled it off.
I'm really glad that it comes across that way.
Yeah.
But I do have to say, the idea of, like, there are real people in the book, I mean, this was a major anxiety for me in writing the book. It's like, nah, actually, like, they're not real people. Like, your characters in a book. Like, I met with real people, and they said things to me, and they told me their narratives, and then I pared these narratives down and, you know, shaped them in certain ways. And that's what it is to write from someone's life. And it's highly anxiety-provoking for me anyway, because I constantly wanted to be including little jagged edges in the text, to be like, I was always feeling caught between creating a story that would read very smoothly and give a reader the sense that, as you say, like, you know these people, they're really there.
Yeah.
And doing what felt to me to be the honest thing of saying, hey, check it out, this is a work of literary creation. It's like, it's not unmediated. Because, and that comes from what I'm talking about, the responsibility of these 130 people that I talk to. Nobody's getting their whole story told.
Yeah.
And in many cases, I probably wind up emphasizing different things from what they would emphasize, because I have this responsibility to this larger story. And I'm not writing an encyclopedia. I'm trying to write an organized narrative. And, you know, I think this is something I'll probably just be grappling with for my whole life as a writer, as long as I do things with enough integrity that people will keep talking to me. I will constantly be wrestling with these questions of honesty and authenticity versus the inevitable shaping and mediation that goes into writing from somebody's life.
You are listening to These Things That People Make. We're doing a fantastic interview with Sarah Marcus, who wrote the book Girls to the Front, and you just heard Heavens to Betsy from These Monsters Are Real. I wanted to mention that all the artists that I've been playing are off really early releases from Kill Rock Stars, and we're going to go back now to the interview with Sarah Marcus.
And I get that a little bit myself, too, because I write about myself in the intro, which I never wanted to do. My agent was like, you have to write about yourself. So I did. And so then I made a new friend recently who then picked up my book and then suddenly was like, oh, in a conversation, oh, yeah, that's like what happened to you when you were 16. And so it was this thing I'd never told him about something that happened to me when I was 16. And he was thinking that I ascribed a certain importance to it because it had that importance in the text.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, wait, but that's not actually, that's how I feel about it to write it, but that's not necessarily how I feel about it to live it.
Yeah. Well, it's the interesting thing about interviewing people, too, right? Where, like, I interview people, I'm not often interviewed, and I was interviewed, like, a couple months ago or something, and found that the questions that the person was asking were also framing things in a way that I wouldn't think about.
Oh, yeah.
And
sometimes that can be really great.
Yeah.
I interviewed some people for my book who would say, oh, I've never gotten a chance to see it that way before, and I'm so glad to have had the opportunity to see it that way.
Hmm, yeah. Yeah.
So it's not always, you know, an act of violence to change somebody's frame.
No.
But I worry that sometimes it is.
Like, are there things that you, like, after writing it, that you feel like you want to talk about? What made you want to write a book like this in this way and not make it an anthology of interviews?
a major thing is that I felt the political context had to be made very explicit. And that is something that, even though teenage girls, including myself in this period of time and in all times, are always living out the social and political forces against which our adolescence unfolds, it's not necessarily on the surface, especially in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
There, I can't tell you how many things when I was doing research for this book came up where I would be like, oh my God, that is why that episode in my life played out the way it did. It was, there was no accident that such and such happened when I was 19 in relation to such and such an institution, because there was this court case in Michigan that absolutely affected the actions of the institution vis-a-vis what was going on with me. And so these are things that one isn't necessarily cognizant of, even if one is reacting to it in ways of like really indigenous intelligence, which is kind of the point I'm trying to make in the book. But had I just gone based on the interviews with people, would have lost the ability to zoom out that way and to really explicate the ways that these particular stories were behaving as particular examples of general principles and larger forces that were going on at the time. So that's one thing. Another thing, though, is when you have an oral history or a collection of interviews that are all first-person voices, the balance between the voices of people you've heard of and the voices of people you haven't heard of is very skewed. You know, I have the book Please Kill Me on my shelf, and I have skimmed it to read the quotes of the people I have heard of and I am interested in. And it seemed to me that creating a narrative was going to be the best way to level that playing field and to make the point I wanted to make about the significance of the lives of teenage girls and young women that you hadn't heard of, who weren't in bands that you'd heard of, but whose experiences were nevertheless really important and illustrative and worth reading about.
So that wraps up this interview and this episode of These Things That People Make. Go to your local independent bookstore and see if you can find Girls to the Front by Sarah Marcus, published by HarperCollins. And if you can't find it, ask them to order it in. If you don't live near an independent bookstore, then visit girlstothefront.com and you can order it online there. Please check out my blog for the radio show, thesethingsthatpeoplemake.blogspot.com. And I'll catch you later on another episode of These Things That People Make.